From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccans. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. If you didn't check the title for today's episode, we're diving deep into something very old that remains very controversial in the modern day. We're talking about religion. It's one of the oldest concepts in human society. It's been the ruinous subject of many Thanksgiving dinner fights. You name it, religion has been somehow involved. Because it's, you know, when you think about this, guys, it's the first example of the human species attempting to explain why something happens. You know, all things like, why does the sun come up? Why does the sun sometimes seem to disappear from the sky? Why are we here at all? Where do we go after this? What happens when we die? What does all of this mean? Why? Religion attempts to answer those questions. And for many people, it provides the only answers that they feel confident in. And it's responsible for tremendous acts of kindness. It's also been a rationalization for countless heartbreaking atrocities. You know, we have a disclaimer I think we need to put in the front here.
We do. And Ben, I think your description of the origin of all religion, of any religion, explains a lot of the conflict that has occurred between religious organizations over the years, because you've got pockets of people living together. Someone or a group of people come up with that explanation of why in their bubble, miles and miles away, maybe continents away. Another group of people does the same thing, but they have their own answers that they come to. And then eventually when those two groups meet, and this is just one example, they have to decide who's right.
And yet there's so much parallel thinking, right? They're like kind of like key tenets in all major religions that all align pretty well. And yet it has to be this like spiritual pissing contest kind of. It always ends up being that. And more than just that, I mean, larger, obviously, whole wars and genocide and all of these, you know, awful things that human beings do, all in the name of my God is better than your God.
And that's why we are saying to you listening to this that we are not making any judgments on anyone's personal beliefs.
Nope.
We would never tell you what to believe, and we're not going to even really tell you what we believe. So we're just going to explore this together in a very not secular way, in a very
even-handed will be our attempt.
There we go. That's our goal.
Pardon my Yoda phrasing, but yeah, we'll try to be even-handed is what I mean. Yeah, and you guys are raising these fantastic and these disturbing points. And of course, on stuff they want you to know, we clearly believe that, as Matt said, your beliefs are your own. It is a private thing, and no one has the right or the power to, quote-unquote, make you believe something else. It is up to you. It is a personal decision. I love the point you bring up about origins of religion there too, because, you know, a lot of, as we'll see in the really murky stuff from the Paleolithic era, a lot of very early religions were, since they were essentially trying to explain things, they were explaining things that were common in a native environment. That's why you would see variations in animal deities, right? They would be based on the animals that are encountered in, you know, in day-to-day life. And so, like, just like you said, Noel, followers of different systems, belief systems, find themselves in constant, countless conflicts with followers of other systems, from ancient wars to acts of persecution that continue in the modern day. And in many cases, as we'll find, and as you've probably found yourself, fellow conspiracy realists,
people of all sorts of faith can live together in peace. You know what I mean? Like, your next door neighbor might be an atheist. They might follow a religion you've never heard of, but still, they're probably going to be cool to you because they're your neighbor.
And it seems to me that this is somewhat of a modern development, that people are able to relatively coexist. Certainly, there are still disputes based on religion. I'm not saying that's not a thing. But, you know, all in all, you don't see quite as many large scale conflicts based exclusively on differences in religious beliefs.
It depends on where you go.
Also true.
In every region, right? So this is the origin point for what we're exploring today. Religion, as you said, you know, people of various faiths have managed to live together in peace, but they have also, at various countless innumerable points, tried to wipe each other out 100%. Today's episode, we're asking, were any of these attempts successful? Are there any forgotten religions? And if so, how did they disappear? Here are the facts. To understand that, we have to first understand the state of what we would broadly call religion in the modern day. Regardless of your own personal beliefs, you are probably pretty well aware on some level of the world's most prominent religions. If you look at the World Population Review, they had some good stats. As of 2020, Christianity is the biggest one in terms of raw population. 2.38 billion followers.
Relatively closely followed by Islam, with 1.91 billion followers.
And then Hinduism comes in with around 1.16 billion followers.
Buddhism is number four at 507 million followers.
And then we have what you could probably term other, but there is a loosely defined name for this category known as folk religions, which comprises about 430 million followers.
And that leaves a lot of people in another category, which is like NA.
Yeah.
Not applicable, maybe.
Or not,
I don't
affiliated
know.
Would be one of the ways those are reported. Or
didn't respond,
right,
to a thing.
Considering oneself broadly spiritual or, you know, other, something like that. These stats are tricky because for a couple of reasons. First, each of these describes a pretty broad category. You know what I mean? A Protestant is not the same as a Catholic. A Shiite is not the same as a Sunni. And over the course of history, there's no shortage of members of the same overall belief system fighting amongst themselves. You know, it can be illuminating for someone in the modern day to read about the various what are considered heresies, disagreements of doctrine in Christianity, because they may seem like a small deal to an outsider, but they're a huge deal internally, and people did die because of these disagreements.
One person's heretic is another person's messiah, right?
Yeah, well put. And this leads us to back to the idea of the commonality, right? Because if you are, for instance, not a follower of Christianity or an adherent to some denomination of Christianity, then it may seem odd to you that various denominations disagree or don't get along, because you think, well, you have a lot of commonality, right? You're all followers of this specific Messiah. You all have some version of the same text, right? So why won't you let each other coexist? And I mean, even three of the world's most well-known religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, share a common lineage. And that common lineage hasn't been enough to prevent conflicts. It's the differences in observation, interpretation, and practice that lead to battle.
That, you know, that is weird that Judaism didn't make it into that World Population Review article, or the thing that we cited there.
Oh, that's true.
That's
odd.
Really interesting.
Well, it's a numbers game.
Yeah, I know. I guess I imagined that there were high enough numbers of followers of Judaism that they would fit in there. But I guess, okay.
Yeah, the population, the world's Jewish population, as of this is older stat, as of 2010, was about 14 million total.
Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like at the bottom of the list. Above it is something called Spiritism. I don't even know what that is.
Hopefully it's what it sounds like, I guess.
So. I guess, yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah, that's very, very fascinating. And it's so interesting, too, because, you know, that it is such a visible population as well. Like in terms of if you go to like certain areas of New York City or Los Angeles or even here in Atlanta, you know, Orthodox Jews population, they definitely tend to cluster in certain neighborhoods and are a very visible part of communities. So it's very interesting that it would be such a low number.
And with people with common spiritual beliefs or cultural background, we find that these groups do tend to cluster together because you have that sense of community. But also the danger of the large numbers is that when a smaller belief system becomes a subject of persecution, whether regionally or globally, terrible, terrible things can happen. And from an anthropological perspective, lest anybody think we're dumping on religion overall, every single religious system you will ever read about, you will ever practice, is itself a priceless monument to the abilities of human belief. And it's a cultural milestone that cannot be replaced. For many, many people, religion is the single most important aspect of their life on earth. And so we know that it provides things that people feel they need. And it's been doing so for a long time. Right now, if you were trying to figure out what is the oldest religion that is still around today, you would hear a couple of different answers. Most scholars will generally agree that Hinduism is the oldest extant religion. I mean, it's still, you know, around in 2021 as we record this, though others will argue that there are some smaller religions that continue today, smaller in terms of population size, like Zoroastrianism. That is a strong contender for this position. It's much less well known, and it's a fascinating story. But let's maybe talk a little bit about Hinduism so we can learn more about sort of the oldest guy in the restaurant of religion.
It is interesting, though, that it doesn't have like a founder that you can point to.
Right.
I've always wondered that, and there really isn't an answer. So it's really hard to trace its origin and the provenance of its you know, religious texts and doctrine. It's quite unique in that it's sort of like a amalgam of several different traditions and philosophies, and again shares quite a few commonalities with Buddhism, for example. But it definitely wasn't the only game in town, right? In terms of the most ancient of religions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's around today. Hinduism has many, many adherents. It dates back to, you know, like more than 4,000 years ago. Most of the followers of Hinduism do reside in India at this time. But while it was around, you know, there were other parts of the world that had completely different belief systems. Many of those have been lost to history. But you're right, Noel. Scholars spend a lot of time and effort trying to pin down the beginning of what we would today recognize as religion, and it becomes controversial so quickly. I got to tell you guys the coolest theory I heard digging into this. It concerns the idea of Paleolithic religions, meaning belief systems that would have been around in 200,000 to 50,000 BCE. It's hard to even understand how long ago that was, but the coolest claim is this, that there were people alive during this time who worshipped bears, bear worship.
Sure. I think it's hard to wrap our heads around because it's also hard to insert ourselves into the mindset of Paleolithic, you know, humans, right?
Yeah.
Like it really points to the fact that, or the idea that religion is sort of this innate thing that doesn't necessarily require like a large amount of intelligence. It just is something that we sort of innately seek, is an explanation for why the sun comes up or why the thing does this or why the herds, you know, travel in this direction and look for things that we can use magical thinking to kind of help us solve day-to-day problems, especially at a time when it would have been a very harsh life and very, you know, difficult to survive.
Well, it's not, for me, it's not difficult to imagine. And the only reason why I say that is because if you try and just close your eyes, put yourself in the mindset of a young child growing up in the Paleolithic era, and you know, you're born into whatever your family situation looks like, whether it's one person to, you know, 100 people living roughly together, especially if you're somewhere where there are large mountains or there's, you know, a large open field where you're high enough up and you can see enough of the planet immediately, no matter what your beliefs are, what your understanding is. There's something that says this is very big. Where I am is very, very big.
Yeah.
There must be powerful things or some things that created this.
I think we're saying the same thing, Matt. I think I was just saying I have a hard time understanding the idea of an intellect of this kind of early, you know, human. But I think you're right. The mind, even lacking the structure and the framework to have more complex tenets of religion, just seeks out the things that you're talking about kind of innately.
There's a scientific basis to it. I'm glad you guys are bringing this up, because the human species did something incredibly interesting from an evolutionary perspective. It began to evolve in a way that prioritized thinking, abstract thought, the brain, right? And the amount of energy the brain takes is pretty fascinating, because it indicates that humans spent a lot of time thinking, right? And becoming tool makers, right? The original form of human hunting, by the way, this is kind of interesting, is called persistence hunting. It's just other animals evolved for quick burst of speed, and then humans just kind of Duracelled it. Or wait, no, Energizer Bunny did, right? They kept going and going and going. So we've evolved to specific things, but one thing that we evolved to is very important, is pattern recognition. So I would argue, like, that's how they became such good hunters. So I would argue that pattern recognition, in a way, this hardwired neurological imperative, can explain how early humans arrived at explanations for things that we would think of as religion, because they literally evolved to say, not just, oh, that happened again, but to say, oh, that happened twice. I wonder if it's going to happen a third time, and if it'll happen at the same time. Let me think about that, right?
Just really quickly, think about the first winter that you can remember. Like, if you're in that time, the first winter that you lived through that you can remember, the reverence that you would have for the heat coming from the sun at the times when heat is coming from the sun. And, you know, you may not even correlate that, oh, I'm warmer now because of that bright thing up there. If you don't have, you know, a language to describe the things, you can at least sense I am warmer when there's light on me and that thing is up in the sky. And then I can see at night to hunt if I have to, or to do, you know, things at night because that other thing is in the sky, or, you know, that thing in the sky has changed now into this other thing. And I can still see. You can just imagine that a reverence gets built up, as you said, with the pattern recognition, Ben.
Yeah, that's
there. You can imagine them culminating,
and you start connecting the dots,
right?
Like, between big magic thing in the sky to don't eat this mushroom, it'll kill you, because I saw some. You know what I mean? Like, there are these ways you start to connect and like say, oh, if this sun, you know, thing represents this, then this other thing represents this, and I have to give it homage and respect it, or else I could actually literally die because, like, all my brothers and sisters did. You know what I mean? I mean, like that recognition, I think, is crucial.
Well, religion, I mean, is the precursor of modern science. It is analytical, right, in its endeavor. And, you know, I know it can sound maybe a little bit cold or soulless to say pattern recognition plays a big part. We do have another episode that you may want to check out if you're interested in these kinds of conversations, and that is uh, the the belief that psychoactive substances may have played a role in early religions. Please do check that out. There's some sand to it. But I love the observation. I mean, you know, as you know, my kind hibernates during winter, so I don't personally know the experience that you're describing, Matt, but I get it. I get where you're at. And people did, you know, the things that have power, these inexplicable things, they must be explained, says the human mind. We seek to understand them. And so it makes sense that some of the first gods would be things like the spirits of the dead, or avatars of powerful natural elements like the sun, the moon, the ocean, and then later social concepts like contracts, friendship, war, things like that, these inevitable parts of the human existence. And now, I hate to say it, right as of now, a lot of people say there's no evidence that humans or Neanderthals really had something they would understand as religious practice, or at least as bear worship. I don't know why I get stuck on that. But also,
because it would have been awesome.
Yeah. But also, this is pre, like, there's not written documentation of this time, right? So it is very, very possible. I would argue probable that there are things that are religious beliefs. They just didn't make it to modern history, right? So as a result of that, we see some of the first forgotten religions, and we will likely never know what they were. Instead, when we search at this like point in the distant past, we have to find physical evidence of practices that imply some sort of belief system, which means like, what is the first time it looks like someone was buried on purpose? You know, that indicates something, right? A fear, perhaps, of the dead, or a belief in the afterlife, maybe.
At the very least, a reverence for life to some degree, which sort of recognizes, to me, a spiritual layer, I think, or at least an awareness of something like that. When was it, Ben? They discovered the first buried child, I believe, around, 78,000 to 74,000 BCE?
Mm-hmm. Earliest known Homo sapien burial of a child at a cave site called Ponga Yasadi in modern day Kenya. It's in like the southeast of Kenya. And the earliest known purposeful burial of a human being at all occurs 100,000 BCE in the Middle East. And of course, countless other people were probably being buried by their loved ones at this time. Like we said, it's tough to know exactly what the logic, what the process, the system was here, but there is that implies a belief system of some sort. And those early people were not the only cases. We have to remember that humans are very, very, very good at losing things and breaking things and destroying things. We've lost entire cities before. Religion is no exception. I can't believe we got this far without referencing REM, but we're all kind of doing the REM song as a species. You know the song.
I'm doing the dance. I'm doing the REM dance right now. The Michael Stipe in the white, you know, collared shirt with a sepia tone background. That video, by the way,
yeah,
absolutely fundamental 90s art rock video that was copied ad nauseum. Just take a look. Watch Losing My Religion and then just think about the 90s and the look of music videos. That is like the prototype. But
well, that's you in the spotlight.
It sure is, baby.
And I appreciate that point because, as we'll see, a lot of religions copy from one another as well, or evolve out of one another. But some haven't been simply forgotten. Some religions, you see, have been lost or erased on purpose. We're going to pause for a quick word from our sponsor, and then we'll dive in. Here's where it gets crazy. Yes, religions can and do disappear over time. Some even experience a resurgence and reappear, right? They go underground because of persecution, and then later they emerge when the whatever insert regime here is passed on. Belief is a durable, powerful thing. And I would say, you know, it's interesting. I was trying to think of how to phrase this. In the very, very early days of human beings thinking along these lines, it's almost like the concept of religion is itself a conspiracy. You are finding hidden truths. You are encountering illumination and revelation. And then on the flip side of that, religious persecution is a genre of conspiracy all its own. It doesn't matter, like, insert the name of any religion you wish, and you will find at some point in history, those people have been persecuted for their beliefs. You also find that people continue, very much so, to be persecuted in the modern day in horrific ways. And it's weird to think, you know, if you live in the U.S., it's pretty strange to imagine a president, whatever president you wish, going on TV from the Oval Office and saying, like, all right, we've had it up to here with the Seventh-day Adventist, you know, or the Baptist. They can't have jobs anymore. They all have to pay an extra tax, and they all have to live in Cincinnati. All right, God bless America. Like, but that kind of stuff happened. Like, versions of that stuff happened all the time. People would be lower class. They would have day-to-day restrictions on movement, social opportunities. This still, again, continues in the modern day, including, like, who they can marry, who they can have kids with. And this also, of course, takes the form of violence up to and including genocide. This is a very real thing.
Thinking about it in that context, you can imagine why some of the groups, the religions that we're going to speak about today, operated in secret. As you said, they had to function in a conspiracy to hold those beliefs, because you had to be careful about who you talked to about your beliefs because of these dangers. So a lot of these groups would, you know, rather than having a temple, a large temple, or, you know, constructing a church of some sort, they would operate underground. You know, they would build a temple under the ground, literally, on purpose, as a way to be able to secret away to practice. And
even during the, you know, Roman rule, when Christianity was a persecuted religion, and they had to mark, you know, their meeting places or speak in code using the fish symbol or whatever. There are various ways of doing that. But yeah, I mean, what is now the world's most prominent religion absolutely used to operate in secret and underground, or face, you know, crucifixion.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. You know, each and every act of religious persecution could be an episode. Forget an episode; it could be an entire series all its own. And what we're going to do is cite several examples of religions that have come and that have gone. And we won't have a comprehensive list of this because, again, there are just so many examples of people doing horrible things to each other and using rationalization for these acts. They have been successful in the past. That's why we'll never know how many religions the species has lost. And additionally, this is kind of funny. I hope this is not me being, like, too soon about it, but this is kind of funny. For some ancient religions, a lot of our information comes from people who hated them. Their regional rivals, their enemies. You run into this with, you know, historical biographies of individuals too, right? Like an emperor dies, and then some archivist or historian or writer wants to curry favor with the new emperor. And so they're like, hey, let me tell you some wild stuff about the guy before you. I heard, you know, he eats toes. I'm trying to make it. I don't know. Just like an example.
Or a conquering force comes through and wipes out the record, any written record,
yes,
you know, that existed. So we only know then from hearsay of people who rolled through with, you know, weapons.
Yeah, the victors go the spoils and the right to tell the story.
Right. History is written by the winners. That's the one. It's a bug for some, a feature for others. But, like, for one quick example of this, the Canaanite religion. If you have read the Bible, which is a pretty popular book, pretty easy to find a copy, then you'll hear mentions of the Canaanite religion, and the authors of the Bible in those sections that mention it clearly they're not down with it. There's not like it's definitely not a like David Attenborough-esque kind of observation. So we're dealing.
It's loaded, is what you mean. Like they clearly feel a way.
Yes,
about it.
Yeah, there's some bias there, and this is something that we see happen in other parts of the world, in other parts of time. So if we look at the Middle East, this is a great example of a place that is awash in religions that the modern world largely forgot. It's the birthplace of civilization, you know? So it makes sense logically that there would be an immense density of religious practice in the Middle East. And before the rise of Islam, the Arabic world had this rich, diverse spiritual ecology, which I think is maybe a little bit of a pretentious term, but it works. The majority of inhabitants in the region until about the 4th century practiced different forms of polytheism, which means a spiritual belief with multiple gods, as compared to something like Christianity, which is monotheistic, there's one god. And even as these growing populations—
Well, there are three, there's one god in three forms.
Yes.
Just to put it up.
And some of us are probably old enough to remember when the Holy Ghost turned into the Holy Spirit, right? Mm-hmm. In the I don't want to call them speeches, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, and don't forget about the saints.
Yes, religious syncretism, which we also have an episode on. Religious syncretism is the idea of mixtaping religion. So if you are proselytizing for a specific belief system. The Catholic Church was tremendously talented at this. For proselytizing for a specific belief system, it's really tough to tell people, hey, that thing that you and your ancestors believed, that's wrong. Do my thing instead. The more clever or subtle way to do it is to say, hey, that God you are worshiping from, you know, the mountain or from the river or whatever, that's actually this person in my belief system. So we're agreeing. Let me just tell you more about what you already believe. I mean, that is
your smooth. Your thing is just it's a smaller thing apart over here. Mm-hmm. That's really this larger thing that I'm going to tell you about.
I can show you the world. Yeah. It's like, it's way less chill than that because they're also doing this while they're doing this, they're using this religious difference as a rationalization to enslave, to torture, to assault and murder people. So it gets ugly real quick. But in the Middle East, you have all these regional polytheistic practices. People have deities that are kind of local to the area. And this continued even as populations of people practicing Judaism and Christianity began to develop into significant minorities. One commonality that these pre-Islamic belief systems had was the belief in a chief god, not a single god overall, but like one god above the rest of the gods, whose name was Hubal, H-U-B-A-L, spelled a couple different ways sometimes. And in fact, it might surprise people to know the Kaaba in Mecca actually was once a repository for representations of many of these gods, hundreds of different gods. Their images were housed in there, in that structure in Mecca. And then according to Islam, this structure was originally built by the biblical Abraham, but later people, after his time, people went in and put those other idols inside. And then when the prophet of Islam, the prophet Muhammad, gained control of the structure, he expelled those idols. So there's clearly, even in that story, there's clearly like an acknowledgement that other belief systems exist, but they are not the true belief system. And they must therefore be excised from society.
Hey man, you got to tear down that golden calf, all those idols, get rid of them. Even that big bull outside of Wall Street. I mean, what?
What? You mean with the little girl facing him off?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Or, well, at least that bull, I don't think they burned people in it yet, which is one of the accusations, right, for the bull worshippers. Yep. But, like, we could see examples of this all the time, because history really is a palimpsest. It's written over itself repeatedly, so... Like, what about Europe, right? Europe is considered, now, as we'll see, Europe is considered increasingly secular, but for a long time, it was like a huge economic force for Christianity and for spreading various belief systems of Christianity. But it wasn't always the case.
And then you had all sorts of flavors of Celtic religions. You had Druids and various forms of regional paganism that, you know, had very specific pantheons of gods and deities that they would worship, that were very regionally specific and not necessarily a universal language or group of gods that everyone knew about. I mean, there certainly were the big ones, you know, for example, let's say worshiping of ancient Roman deities like Pan or certain personifications of nature. I think paganism has always been fascinating to all of us, and it's also very misunderstood and is often, I think, misconstrued with devil worship or various, you know, forms of witchcraft, for example, but it really is its own thing.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's the term itself, which comes from, it's funny because paganism, like you said, is associated sometimes with devil worship, quote unquote, but really the term etymologically means rural. It's like country people. That's what it was originally meant. And it was a term used by practitioners of early Christianity to apply to anybody who was had polytheistic beliefs in the Roman Empire. They were like, okay, that's if you're anything that's not a Christian, you're pagan, right? And this is super unfair to these, as you said, Noel, very specific regional religions that are not, you know, they're not united by a common language, often not united by a common culture. They exist on their own.
I'm sorry, Ben, I don't want to cut you off, but I would just say the connection to nature with some of those religious beliefs, it was very strong, and possibly because of the rural nature of their lifestyle, the people who followed many of these religions, like the harvest was very important. And, you know, it was worthy of worshiping a deity that would help your harvest out. I don't know. I'm just wanted to make that point.
Because, again, everybody we're talking about is intelligent. They're highly intelligent. They are logical, rational actors. So they are explaining the world in the best way they can. And other people just disagree with their explanations in a very violent way. If you want to get a modern look, this is tangential, but if you want to get a modern look at pagan-inspired art, I would highly recommend spending some time on YouTube checking out Heelung, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly. They're a folk music band from Germany and parts of Northern Europe. I'm going to send you guys a clip if you haven't seen them yet. It's awesome. It's the whole nine. I can't recommend it enough.
Oh, I can't wait to check it out. Another, you know, and you're right, Ben, we caveated this whole discussion from the start in saying that, yeah, we don't have bulleted lists for all of these categories because some of these things were successfully eradicated. But one that I think is interesting, and I think it's something that'll hit a chord with all three of us, is the snake god Glycan, which is actively promoted and worshipped by the comic book writer Alan Moore, who fancies himself a bit of a magician, and he wears a ring on his hand that is this kind of like intertwined snake, you know, image. It almost looks like Oren from the Neverending Story series, the seal, the metal thing that's on the book. But yeah, Glycan was a pagan deity that was worshipped, and it was a cult that was very influential when the Romans were trying desperately to eradicate all of these types of religions. And they were relatively successful in being able to continue their traditions and staying underground. And obviously that has persevered today, even if it's not super mainstream at all. And it's funny because Alan Moore actually refers to this, it's almost like he's doing it as a gag or like a kind of like a satire, satirical form of religion, because he refers to it as a hoax deity. But we do know there is evidence, like back in ancient Macedonia, even, you know, of cults or groups, rather. You know, the term cult is so loaded, but you know, it can refer to, I guess, a small group of devoted followers that worship a particular individual or deity, and of these individuals actually worshiping a real serpent that represented this god Glycan. So, you know, Alan Moore, whatever his intentions are, whether tongue-in-cheek or sincere, he is keeping it alive. And it has made enough of an impact and stuck around long enough in the historical record to be around today. So I guess they did something right in not becoming one of those casualties that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes people who come in later generations will use whatever scant resources or other documents are available to resurrect an ancient religion. And this was really common in the days of theosophy and the age of spiritualism. People would have these discoveries or these revelations, and they would say, I'm not introducing a new religion. I'm bringing the old one back. You know, this was an attempt to, in many cases, acquire some sort of street cred in a way. But you're right. And that's an excellent example of a really common practice. What we're saying is that Europe, the European continent at this time, was incredibly varied, right? And there wasn't the sort of religious uniformity that Christianity would later seek to impose, and largely successfully. And that's kind of ironic itself, right? Because as you'll recall, Christianity itself was persecuted throughout most of the history of the Roman Empire. They were the bad guys. And while we're on the subject of cults, one thing that's interesting, you can see definitions of tactics that modern cults use. But if we're talking about this, maybe are the best way to define that is by a religion practiced in secret, right? That has mysteries that are unavailable to the uninitiated. And this is where we go to some more, I am so compelled with these. I'm so interested in Manichaeism and Mithraism. One of the extreme examples of religious persecution occurs with this first one. Manichaeism, founded in 3rd century AD, they had this dualistic cosmology. So life, your existence, about two things: a struggle between the spiritual world of light, that's the good side, and the evil material world of darkness. This religion went viral, kind of. And, you know, these belief inherently is mimetic, right? So this religion spread like wildfire, but it was successfully stamped out by the Roman Empire. And right now, as we record, there's an interesting plot twist, because there are growing rumors that some form of Manichaeism may persist in isolated areas of China. There's not enough research out there to say for sure yet, but again, belief, powerful, durable, hard to kill.
And it's similar to Zoroastrianism, I believe, in that it, and also, I guess, Gnosticism, where it has its own mythology that is very unique to the belief, and its own kind of innate philosophy. I mean, you know, we've done a whole episode, I believe, with Joe McCormick on Gnosticism, and its sort of interesting twists on deities we might recognize, you know, from other religions. But the idea of having a whole mythology that's unique to a belief system, I think, is very fascinating, even if there are overlaps, and especially key points that are very similar between the different beliefs. But yeah, it looks like the Romans did a fine job of stamping this one out. Fascinating that it would still be around in certain tiny areas of China. Maybe, right?
Maybe, yeah. And Zoroastrianism, just a quick note there, was in play at this time. Zoroastrianism had more followers in terms of raw numbers, but Manichaeism was, could be, for a time, it was arguably more successful because it spread further, you know, made it out to China. And then it also counted among its members some high-ranking political figures.
Mm-hmm. Guys, I think that's really important, the high-ranking political figures, because that leads right into some of my personal beliefs about Mithraism. But I won't bring it up here. Remind me to talk about something before we finish talking about Mithraism, okay?
Okay. All okay. Right, you got it. Yeah, okay. So let's go to Mithraism.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Mithraism is a mystery religion. It was a mystery religion. Again, that, you know, and it's a cult because they practiced in secret. And you were, if you were not a follower or a member of Mithraism, if you weren't going into that underground temple in secret, then you wouldn't know what their rituals were. You weren't supposed to. We do know they worshipped a deity named Mithras, which is Akkadian for contract. And Mithras was the god of friendship, order and contract, these folks were super, super duper into secrecy. This cult begins late first century, and it spreads from the Italian peninsula to border regions, all across the Roman Empire. Right now, there are no written narratives or theology from the religion itself. It's still, though, the Roman Empire, right? They also wanted to stamp out things that they thought were subversive or a danger to the status quo. And Mithraism, for a time, kind of had it was kind of an exception because the followers of Mithraism supported the Roman Empire, the people of power, you know? And although they conspired, they were, you know, in general, they were seen as not a subversive force.
You will find videos across the internet and writings that say the cult of Mithras exists today. And I believe it's because of that connection to friendship, contract, and order, because it really does speak to big business, essentially, to large markets working together. You can see how the beliefs that we know of that the cult of Mithras had would translate really well to a group of people working together to build empires, to like the Roman Empire, to build monetary empires. You can see why this belief, at least in the modern age, that this group persists. You can see why people would think that, maybe.
Sure,
was that the thing we were supposed to remind you to talk about?
No, that's okay. I know we're running long here already. The thing I wanted to talk about is that many of these religions, like Manichaeism that we were talking about there, show this dualism that I think is really fascinating.
Sure.
So you've got the light and the dark, right? That you can see that mirrored in a lot of religions, even ones that exist today.
Is Yaldabaoth going to show up in this?
There's some in here, not necessarily these two that we're talking about right now, but there are some of these that have been lost that supposedly had a tethering between the plane of matter, this physical plane, and a spiritual plane, where there were two versions of you, of an individual, that existed simultaneously in both planes, essentially.
Like a multiverse kind of situation?
Almost. Dualyverse. A dualyverse, yeah. It's closer to simulation theory, almost. Like there's a version of you or an intelligence that is a part of you that exists on some other plane that manipulates this one, or that this one manipulates that one. I don't know. It's just fascinating to me.
Before we go to break, I got to ask you, Matrix 4, what's your position?
I don't know. Matrix 2 or 3 weren't that great, in my opinion. So we'll see. I don't know. Maybe it'll be cool. A long time's passed. I hope it's good.
I am purposefully removing myself from any and all materials coming out about it, and I will watch it when it is released.
All right.
And I'll tell you after that.
Last thing. Sorry, I know we keep having last things. Mithras, do you think there's any connection to the mystical material in the Lord of the Rings books, Mithril? A chain mail that can't be penetrated?
No
possibly.
Comment.
Possibly.
I don't know.
I have to ask a Tolkien scholar, but
yeah, who knows? Maybe we should ask Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, there you go.
He would probably know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's pause for a word from our sponsors. I'll text Steve and then we'll come back if he gives us an update. All right. We have returned. Steve texted me just like a weird emoji. So I'm going to have to dig into Tolkien to figure out the etymology there. But he did, you know, he did spend a lot of time working as a linguist, you know, in the construction of those worlds. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are echoes. This is the big moment here. We've talked a lot about various religious conflicts. We've talked about how religions get suppressed. We've talked about how some religions can suppress others, or at least people who claim to practice those religions will use a religion as an excuse to oppress other people. But we promised you we would talk about times where religions have been erased. This is almost a parable now. It's a story that I think we all enjoy. It's fascinating. It happened long enough ago that we can laugh at the hubris of it. But way back in the day, Egypt straight up erased an entire religion successfully and purposely. Well, not all the way successfully, because we know about it today, but they did their best and they did a really good job. It's something called Atenism, A-T-E-N-I-S-M. It's a religion centered on a sun god named Aten. It was debatably monotheistic, but it's probably better to say the followers of this belief system, the followers of Atenism, believe that other gods could exist or were believed to exist, but that Atenism and Aten himself was, you know, the main deal, the primary spiritual entree. It was Egypt's state religion for just 20 years in the 14th century BCE, and it's all because of this pharaoh named Akhenaten. Over his reign, he founded this cult himself. It was kind of about Aten, but it was really all about how important he was in the religion. It's a very self-serving religion because, you know how in the Catholic belief system, the clergy is your connection to God, right? And that's a big doctrinal difference between some other denominations of Christianity and Catholicism. In this belief system, in this cult, there was only one guy who could talk to God.
Yeah.
Single
conduit, and he lived at the top of that giant building. But, you know, he was closer to the heavens or whatever. But, yeah, you could totally see how it was a bit self-serving. What if it was the real? What if Atenism was the real true religion? That was the one.
Well, we missed the boat on that one, Matt, because as soon as he died, later rulers, with the support of the people, threw this stuff in the garbage. You know, after he passed away, his cult enters a decline gradually at first, but then at a pretty hectic pace, the pre-existing beliefs return because he's fighting against thousands of years of tradition and culture. And we were talking off air about this, but it reminds me of like Coke 2 or New Coke when that came out. In the 80s. There's a conspiracy about that as well. I don't know if you guys have heard this, that apparently was made to distract people from changing the recipe of original Coca-Cola. Not confirmed yet, but anyway, this guy's move was tremendously unpopular. Folks, imagine you have friends that you get together with and you play a game every week. It could be Magic the Gathering, maybe you have like a jam band, or maybe you have like Dungeons and Dragons or board game, whatever, you know, COD, it doesn't matter. You get together every week, and then one of the people you get together with every week they say, I've got a new idea. We're going to play a game. It's about me, and I'm the only person who can win, okay? We're all going to play this game. The minute they're gone, you guys will be like, that's wacky. What is wrong with this person? And this guy only got away with it because he was pharaoh, you know, because he was the pharaoh at the time. So as soon as, like pretty much as soon as he's dead, the coming pharaohs destroy temples. All the temples that are built to this guy, or most of them. And they don't just destroy them. They take the building blocks and they use it in other construction projects, and they take some of those blocks and they build new temples to the god Amun, who was the god they liked the whole time that this pharaoh was making them cosmologically kiss his butt.
All hail Amun, man.
Yeah, well, not that, you know, it's not like pharaonic rule was anything like a bastion for democracy or something. He's an interesting example, but don't think other pharaohs were all, you know, heroes in comparison, right?
Yeah.
It's just really weird that you could have, like, the chutzpah of that,
you know? Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. But if I've learned anything from Stargate, it's that, you know, Amun-Ra is an extraterrestrial and has a cool spaceship.
Is this Stargate the series or Stargate the singular motion picture?
Pretty sure this is the movie.
Yeah.
It was good. Yeah, with the guy from The Crying Game in it.
Mm-hmm. But in short, you know, what happened is that it seems the people at the time weren't really digging this concept. And even though they didn't, even though they weren't into it, you'll find some scholars that conjecture the rough concept of one God over others. Or later, even just the concept of monotheism, a single God to rule them all. This concept may have gone on to influence other later religions. So in a way, the shadow of Aten may still be extant on the earth.
And I just wanted to bring something up. I was considering asking to have it taken out, but I think I'm not. At the top of the show, I mentioned how, hey, at least things are a little better now. People don't like beef over religion as much as they used to. And that's certainly, I think, partially true, but it's also, I mean, we're talking about things that have happened in 2011, you know? I mean, with ISIS trying to, you know, literally murder people for not converting to Islam, and obviously the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. All these things are very, very real. Maybe they're more isolated and smaller groups, but there very much still is a conflict between people of different faiths. And the question that I think that leads to is, are there religions that exist now? The big five or whatever, however many there were, I think it was four plus other, on a long enough timeline that might be wiped out in the future.
Yeah, will modern religions die out? Again, we've just got a few examples illustrating a much larger concept, but the answer is conclusively yes, some religions have died out. Yes, some have been the victims of conspiracy, and they have been purposely erased from the earth. But the process may continue today in two ways. One is kind of new. Let's talk about the new one. In 2011, the BBC reported on a study, or several studies, that said nine countries seem set to overall say goodbye to religion and become increasingly secular. Not by persecuting religious people. It's just more and more residents of those countries are less. It's less and less of an important part of their life. You know, they're the people who might say, I'll go to church or temple if it's a big holiday and my family makes me, but I don't think about it every day. Interesting quote I found from Richard Weiner of the Research Corporation for Science Advancement in University of Arizona. He says, quote, in a large number of modern secular democracies, there's been a trend that folks are identifying themselves as non-affiliated with religion. In the Netherlands, the number is 40%. The highest we saw was in the Czech Republic, where the number is 60%. And this is, you know, this might be depressing to some people who consider themselves very religious, but if you look at all the bloody conflicts of the past, this is kind of a peaceful rise of secularism. And I would argue it's better than the alternative, which would be religious persecution or persecution for people not being religious, for being apostates, you know, or atheists.
You know, I don't want to go back to Night City too much, guys, but it just... one day, what if religions are completely taken out of the picture and it's corporate persecution?
Yeah, like the THX, what was it, 1138? Mm-hmm. It's a great scene with that. Yeah, and, you know, I think that's a really good point that we should come back to. Remind me before we wrap, because I got a pitch for you guys.
We've certainly talked about the idea that money and wealth and the belief in all of these things is in and of itself its own kind of faith and its own kind of thing that can govern people, and that in many ways can be stronger because it's tied to, you know, results. It's very results driven, you know.
Right. And there's an argument there, an idea that is controversial to some, but it's the concept of religion or a belief system as a kind of technology. And if we look at it through that lens, then it's understandable that people may misuse that technology for their own ends, just the same way you would with fire or with a knife. And, you know, we said there are two ways this is happening. We gave you the newest way, peaceful rise of secularism. And now the problem is that the second way we're going to mention is the tried and true, the Coca-Cola classic of religions dying out, which is violence. In 2014, ISIS launched a genocide against people of the Yazidi faith. They also called them devil worshippers due to specific aspects of their doctrine.
And I very poorly alluded to this earlier and cited it as 2011, but
they were still trying to kill them in 2011.
Mm-hmm. But this is a very specific event. So this is, yeah.
They killed thousands, as many as 5,000 men who refused to convert to Islam. They enslaved thousands of others. This was so extreme that today, thousands of women who are enslaved and trafficked remain officially missing. And this is a real world thing. This is a real world impact. And right now, at present, billions of people around the world consider themselves members of one faith or another to some degree or another, and that doesn't seem set to change anytime soon. And no one is saying that it has to or it should. At least none of us are saying that, because, you know, some of the folks in the crowd today, you know that membership in a spiritual community can bring great benefits, both physical and mental. Look into blue zones, the parts of the world where people tend to live much longer than others. Community and a sense of cohesion is a huge part of that.
Not to get personal about it, but I often wish that I were more able to be more religious. I grew up, you know, in that world, and then I kind of abandoned it, and it's not something that's part of my life. But I see people that are what I would consider good examples, positive examples of people that have faith, and it does seem to make them happier, and it does seem to serve a very functional purpose in their lives. And sometimes I feel like that's missing, and I kind of, you know, wish that I were more in that mindset. So there are absolutely physical benefits and mental health benefits to following a certain religion and the way it guides your life and makes you a quote unquote better person.
And I had a difficult time researching this episode because I didn't want to put, because we're talking about people who are like, no, do my thing. So I didn't want to talk about my old stuff, but I think we're hitting on things that everybody can on some level identify with, you know, and we're trying to be respectful about this because not to like quote Arby's, different is good, but the variations in belief systems, you know, can help humanity learn to look at itself in new ways, its struggles and its triumphs. But the problem with this is that right now, from what we understand, the existence and importance of religion inherently means that there will be practices of persecution and oppression that follow it like a shadow. Those seem set to continue even in countries with laws explicitly banning abuse, harassment, or persecution based on faith. You know what I mean? The U.S. has laws against this, and religious institutions are still getting attacked. This is a huge issue. I mean, we could say, let's hope that humans can learn to dwell on commonalities rather than differences. Biologically, everybody listening to this needs the same basic stuff. Psychologically or socially, like to your point, Noel, humans also tend to want the same kind of mental experiences, right? You want safety. You want a sense of belonging, you know, to something larger than you and being an important part of it. You want a sense that you're making the world a little bit of a better place, at least for your loved ones, at least giving your kids a better shot than you had. That is like, it doesn't matter what your belief system is. That is what most people actually want. And if we can recognize that and we can appreciate it, it's an inarguable common ground, then that might be the best defense against these ongoing conspiracies to persecute or attack people because of their religion in the modern day. I yield my time. Sorry.
Yes. You know, no, it's, wow.
Excellent points.
One of the only other things we can all agree on is that horsey sauce is far superior to Arby's sauce.
Oh, God, yeah. What even is Arby's sauce? I don't understand. Not a fan. But I do have to give a shout out to their marketing department because they are very clever. They're one of the like foremost like snarky social media feeds in all of fast fooddom.
We have the meats.
Mm-hmm. They had a venison burger for a while, too. I was sad that I couldn't get to it.
I didn't know about that. But this is all certainly food for thought, and whatever your religious persuasion is or lack thereof out there, we would love to know what you think. Do you think that religions are going to be continuously in conflict until time immemorial? Or is it going to kind of become more of a mono culture in terms of like I love your idea, Matt, of either some sort of techno religion that everyone is invested in, maybe by force or just by virtue of social evolution.
Yeah, I'm calling it now. It's the cult of Arasaka 2070.
I don't understand that reference, but I
it's
like
all
it.
Good. It's all good.
So let us know what you think, and let us know. This is something we didn't have time to get to today because we're running long, but let us know whether you believe, as some do, that there are secret religions existing, kind of like the cult of Mithras in the modern day. You know, yeah. Maybe did some go underground and just never come back up? If so, what are they?
And do you have an address where we can go and visit them?
Anywhere but Bohemian Grove. We would love to hear from you. We try to make it easy to find us online.
Find us on the internet in the usual social media places of note. We are Conspiracy Stuff on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. You can also reach us via a telephone number.
Yes, our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. When you call, give yourself a nickname or use your real one. That's fine, but be careful. let us know if you can use what you say on air. And if you want to say anything personally to us, please leave it at the end of the message. Let's see, if you've got a lot to say and you want to send supplementary links or anything like that, the best way to get that to us is to use our good old-fashioned email address. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.